My guest today is often known as America's most famous rabbi. He recently wrote a book about the most famous rabbi of all time. Join me as I talk with Rabbi Shmuley Boteach.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, tomorrow night in New York City, an event that I have really been looking forward to, where I get to engage my debating partner and dear friend, Rabbi Shmuley Boteach, on the question of kosher Jesus. And I'm pleased to tell you that Rabbi Shmuley is my guest this entire hour on The Line of Fire. He is like the wind, and we've been able to catch the wind for this next hour. If you've got a question you'd like to ask Rabbi Shmuley Boteach, as long as it is a relevant question to his life and activities and interests, we'll get to some of your questions by phone. You can also post your questions on my Facebook page. That's Ask Dr. Brown, Ask Dr. Brown, where we're getting a bunch of questions already. Here's the number to call, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Tomorrow night, 7:30 p.m., New York City, God willing, at the New York Ethical Culture Center right near Central Park. 7:30, we'll be engaging the topic, kosher Jesus. Hey, Shmuley, thanks for coming on the air today.
It is so typical of you, Mike. It's so typical of you to start the interview with a put-down, calling me nothing but mere wind, gossamer, lacking in substance, having no meat or flesh, just being a passing breeze. I understand exactly what you're saying.
Well, you know, it's so typical of you to start the interview by misconstruing my words and trying to take them out of context. You know, this is almost like two fighters at the weigh-in the day before where they go face-to-face. But really, it's a joy to have you on the air. And thanks for taking time out of your schedule. Hey, we just got a couple minutes.
It's a pleasure to be on your show. And let me start by saying that I want to wish you and your wife my sincere condolences on the passing of Nancy's mother last week. It must be a very difficult time for you and your family, and you know, may God bless you and comfort you.
Yeah, Shmuley, thanks so much. Actually, I had a message from Nancy to convey to you for both of the messages that you left on her personal phone. Just it meant a lot to her. She really appreciated it. And hopefully tomorrow after the debate, I'll get her on the phone and the two of you can talk face-to-face. But let's just get something out here for the general public. In the next minute and a half before we go to our first break, when we're debating, I mean, we absolutely sincerely have deep differences as Jews. I mean, a deep, deep theological divide. But is this friendship thing just put on? Is this like some fun thing we put on for the public? What happens behind the scenes?
It's not a put on for me. Mike, I disagree with your missionizing activities towards Jews. I disagree vociferously. I'll do everything I can to stop them. But that doesn't mean I dislike you personally in any way. I think that you're a very decent man. I think that you have a very big heart. You and I have shown each other sincere affection and friendship for years now. We've acknowledged and been there for each other's life cycle events. You flew up from North Carolina to attend my first child's wedding this past November. I was very moved that you came. I went out of my way to dance with you personally at my daughter's wedding, in front of everyone there, because I respect you and I have affection for you. This is not a put-on in the slightest. You know, America is so torn apart by hatreds and rivalries, and we can't be guilty of either. The fact is that Jews and Christians are brothers, and they are brothers under God. I believe that Jews have to honor their incarnation, of course, to use the words of my friend Marianne Williamson. We find God through our Judaism, and I believe that you should as well. You're a Jew. And I believe that my Christian brothers and sisters should find God through their Christianity. To the extent that you've crossed over and embraced Christianity, I think that's a mistake, and I should say that politely and respectfully. But I have no qualms whatsoever with the Christian faith, which, as you know, I have praised on countless occasions as being one of the greatest forces for good in the world today. And my Christian brothers and sisters, I love them, and I am with them, and we're all trying to serve God.
All right, Shmuley, we got to take a break. This friendship is equally sincere on my part as are the differences. We'll be back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
My special guest today, this entire hour, believe it or not, is Rabbi Shmuley Boteach, known as America's most famous rabbi, my debating partner all over America, even in Canada and England, and looking forward to the debate tomorrow night on the subject of kosher Jesus, question mark, 7:30 tomorrow night at New York Ethical Culture Center in Manhattan. 866-34-TRUTH if you have a question for Rabbi Shmuley. Shmuley, before we get into some theological issues, people want to know about this congressional run. Are you serious about this? Is this just another way of getting
I'm
your...
I'm very serious, and I'm running, God willing. And I'm running for many reasons, but foremost among them, Mike, is America needs a return to its values. Here's another area where I have some disagreements with my Christian brothers and sisters. I think that there's a profound discrepancy in the United States today. On the one hand, we're the most religious country in the Western world. 92% of Americans believe in God, as opposed to 42% of the British. 80% of Americans are church or synagogue going, as opposed to about 38% of the British. And yet, we have one of the most decadent cultures in the world. How is that possible? Because religion is not seeping down into the culture. We are wasting and expending so much unnecessary energy on tangential issues like gay marriage instead of shoring up heterosexual marriage. Gay marriage is going to affect 7-8% of the population. The 50% divorce rate affects 1 out of 2 marriages in the United States. I'm trying to bring back a new valued conversation. I am running as a Republican. I believe in limited government. The economic issues are absolutely paramount. We have to create more jobs. We have to reduce the national debt. That's all obvious. And as far as President Obama is concerned, we need a much more robust foreign policy that projects American power and American belief in freedom and independence throughout the world. But I'm especially focused on values-based issues. Like, I think there should be a moment of silence beginning every public school day so that kids can reflect on issues larger than themselves. We're not going to impose prayer on them, but we can get them to contemplate some of life's larger issues. Or if they want to think about last night's TV show, that's their prerogative.
Do these kids have the ability to think reflectively for a minute, or has our instant society and endless online connectivity and texting and so on robbed the ability even to reflect? Would they know what to do with a minute of reflection?
Well, I think kids are innately seeking answers to profound questions. I mean, it's amazing. You know, I'm raising 9 children, thank God. It's amazing what your children will ask you. I think all kids have depth. We pull the depth out of them by addicting them to trivialities, but they have innate depth. I think that they, when told by a teacher you're being given a moment every morning to think about something that's valuable or precious to you or something important, I think they will do so, and the ones that don't will choose not to, but at least afford a child that opportunity. I also think we need more values-based education in the schools. There should be a course taught in the public schools that is a comprehensive overview of the values that have made America exceptional, whether it's thrift and entrepreneurship and personal accountability and deeper values that can't be construed as religious but are more universal. I don't see that values should be pulled out of the public schools. But, of course, parents who want to send their kids to a parochial school or a religious school should be able to do so without being penalized. The fact is that we need school vouchers. Parents should be allowed to choose their child's environmental educational environment, which accounts for the majority of their waking day. And since America is all about personal freedoms and personal choices, I find it amazing that the government determines for us where we could send our kids, that if you want to send your kids to a religious or a parochial school, that the government won't even fund the geometry, mathematics, or geography courses that you're paying for from your high property taxes. There's very high property taxes in the United States today. Where I live in New Jersey, we have some of the highest taxes in the entire country. And not $1 of that can go to help defray my children's educational costs. Why should I be penalized for wanting to teach my kids about their Jewish heritage and education? I'm not asking the government to pay for that, but surely the government can pay for their secular education. It's our money, after all.
And what about your controversial Blue Laws proposal?
Yeah, you know, I wanted to ask you about that. I'm glad that you're bringing that up, because I value your opinion on this. First of all, why are they controversial? I live in Bergen County, New Jersey, which has one of the only, you know, remaining blue laws, where certain businesses cannot open on Sundays because of the, well, it's sort of the idea of the American Sabbath, but even if you pull it away from any religious overtone, the neighborhoods don't want traffic. They don't want clogged traffic arteries. They want the communities to be a bit more relaxed on Sunday. I don't see why that's controversial. I think that we have to recreate
It's controversial because you're a rabbi, and you're saying, well, you should have blue laws on Sundays. So some people are saying, well, as a rabbi, shouldn't you be advocating for a universal Sabbath on the seventh day? Or isn't this separation of church and state being – I think part of our cultural deterioration is reflected on this, that say, Sunday, which is supposed to be a sacred day for Christians. I'm perfectly happy with a seventh-day Sabbath observance, but Christians, historically, Sunday, the sacred day, that it's really the big day for the NFL. It's the big day for everything else. There's no distinction between that and anything else. So I recognize this as further deterioration in our culture, even in our lifetimes. But, you know, the question comes up, what about separation of church and state? And how can you, as a rabbi, propose a Sunday blue law? That's why some people say it's controversial.
Well, the controversy that I heard so far is how can I, who's running as a Republican, advocate government intervention in business because we believe in more limited government. Let me address that one first. Look, limited government doesn't mean no government. It means limited government, and the government has to step in areas of emergency or crisis. So, for example, and sometimes during war, there's a draft that infringes on our personal liberty, but it's necessary for that time, and it's limited. It will end when the war is over. I think that we need 5 years to help recreate the American family, and our goal should be cutting the divorce rate in half. So if it means pushing families more towards parks and away from department stores and getting parents to interact a bit more, I would probably welcome that. I'd have to look at what individual proposals, et cetera, before committing to any kind of law, but I think that we need to bolster the American family. As far as having it on Sunday rather than Saturday, look, I currently run my organization, This World of Values Network, runs a Turn Friday Night into Family Night national initiative to create a family dinner on Friday night, not only because it's the Jewish Sabbath and sacred to Jews. Friday is sacred to Muslims. Friday is sacred to Catholics and Christians because it's the day that Jesus died. And it's also, even if we could use the word sacred, for atheists and agnostics, because it's the beginning of the weekend when you don't have to work and you actually have family time. So why delay that family dinner to Saturday or Sunday afternoon? Having said that, Sunday is the day that everyone universally consecrates, in the United States, that is, to family time and to people don't work on Sundays. So I absolutely salute the creation of American Sabbath on Sunday. The majority of the population of the country is Christian, and I honor that. I do not believe we live in a Christian country. America has no religion. But the majority is Christian, and Sunday is what it is already. Even if you're, but I'm not saying this as a religious thing. Sunday is not a religious day for most people. It can be a family day. Let it be a family day. But the blue laws in our county are not preserved for any religious purpose. They are preserved in order to limit commerce so that communities can be less clogged. They could be more family oriented, and Sunday can be more enjoyable rather than being stuck in traffic because everyone's going to shop.
All right, so we've got about a minute and a half before the next break. Let's just finish this up, the political end, then we can shift topics. But can you really believe that there would be any kind of positive moral shift in America without people turning back to God? Can it just happen through moral effort and law, or does there have to be a national spiritual revival?
Well, obviously, I would welcome a national spiritual revival. America, remember, Mike, I lived in England for 11 years, which is living in the post-Christian era, for the most part, Western Europe. And I think the absence of God in Western European cultural and political life is a tremendous liability, and I think it explains some of the problems that they're facing. Having said that, I don't know that we have to use the language of God specifically because there is separation of church and state. I think all people believe in value. And that's why I use the language of values. I think values are universal. I think they apply and they appeal to agnostics and atheists and Christians and Jews and Muslims and everyone in between, because we all want to raise good kids and we all want to have a life that is purpose-filled and purpose-driven. And without values, that's not going to happen. And I think that the values of religion, which have become universal, are applicable even to people who are not believers.
Got it. All right. And what's going to have to happen? We've got 30 seconds for you to move forward with your campaign desire to run for office.
We're moving forward, God willing, and I would ask everyone to please offer their support at shmuleyforcongress.com. Again, it's S-H-M-U-L-E-Y for congress.com, for F-O-R, not the number. What has to happen is I need to raise money, I need to get support, and I need to get traction. I hope this candidacy will have traction. Let's face it, it's a different kind of campaign. It's a values-based campaign. That's what I've said from the beginning. I know that we're focused on the economy. I know that we're focused on jobs, but I believe that the economic erosion in America directly results from the values erosion. We have to bolster our values.
Yeah, in fact, a few months ago, I wrote an article called It's the Morality Stupid, based on the advice to Clinton when he was running, It's the Economy Stupid. I said, It's the Morality Stupid. All right, when we come back, we'll get into a little bit of controversy with Rabbi Shmuley and talk about his Kosher Jesus book.
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, I'm sitting here smiling. I want to bring a caller on to talk to Rabbi Shmuley Boteach. We've got a lot of time. We want to talk about his book, Kosher Jesus, why he wrote it. I'll tell him why he's wrong. He'll tell me why he's right as we get ready for our debate tomorrow night. 866-34-TRUTH if you have a question. But I see one of our callers here, Dan. I'm looking at the last name, which I won't mention on the air. Yeah, we went to high school together. Dan knew me when I was a heroin shooting LSD using guy called Drug Bear. He knew me after I became the born again and a follower of Jesus. So, Rabbi Shmuley, I want you to talk to Dan for a moment. Dan's a long time man. We haven't talked, Dan. You're an attorney right now, and I think you have some issues of you think you can have values without religion? Is that right?
Am I on, Michael?
You're on, Dan, and Rabbi Shmuley is ready to address you. So go ahead.
Great to hear your voice, buddy.
Good, long time, man.
Mike, good to hear you. Really, pleasure. Yeah, Rabbi. I grew up with Mike. I have a secular belief standard. I teach in college now. I'm an attorney still. A father. I've raised my kids as secular Jews. I've taught in and I've run a workman circle, Shula, where we teach secular Jewish education. Without religion, we teach religion not anachronistically, but we teach religion as part of the Jewish people, but you don't have to accept it. What we do teach, though, is, you know, for a shener and a besser welt, you know, a better and a prettier world. So Mike and I have been going back about this as long as we know each other, since he's, you know, found Jesus, in that I believe this can be affected without religion. And Mike says you need faith. What do you say?
So what do you say to that, Shmuley, especially to a fellow Jew?
Well, what is absolutely undeniable is that there are plenty of non-believers, people who are complete and utter atheists, who are extremely moral and decent people. So clearly, empirical evidence demonstrates that you can be, that you can have values without having religion. I mean, that's clear. The question is, where did those values come from? Like, how do we know what is valuable when we speak of values? And what's also clear is that even if atheists are not prepared to ascribe their values to religion, of course they come from religion. I'll give you one example. How do we know that life is of infinite value, and how do we know that people are equal? On the contrary, a lot of people who don't believe in God speak of the quality of life. Only religion speaks of the sacredness of life, and that means that life is of infinite value. Why are we keeping people in their 80s who are very ill alive in hospitals? Because we believe that even where quality of life has been compromised, the sanctity remains. You pull that away and you get a really scary world where they start deciding, well, you know what, I don't think this is a good use of resources to keep this woman alive for just another 2 years. You know, let's stop treatment. If it's your grandmother, you don't feel that way. You feel a sacred connection to her, even if you're not religious. So values come from religion, even if people don't give it credit. But it's absolutely true that you could be a complete, someone who denies God vehemently and a very moral human being.
See, maybe the culture has given me what I've taken from it, And I agree that, you know, I teach the fact that, you know, religious values have given rise to constitutional thought, et cetera. The founders were deists, you know, they may not have been, you know, Catholics or Protestants, but they absolutely deists and things like that and believed in a higher life form. In my, or in Danny's world, as Mike knows, it's I'm in the here now. And with what I can do, it's almost altruistically, almost DNA. And Mike says, look, you have to ascribe, you know, that to God. And I say, I ascribe that just to DNA. It's almost like genetic inequality in my line. I don't know. Maybe that's spirituality to somebody else. But I have a very, very hard time when I hear that, you know, and I appreciate that you're running for office, and I wish you all the best luck in the world. But when you tell that there should be a moment of silence in school, to me, you know, the schools don't even have enough time to get across the three R's, let alone teach American exceptionalism.
Well, you know, that's a very interesting point, and I appreciate it. I love good questions, and you're very provocative, and you and Mike had a great time growing up together.
Mike
is blessed.
I read recently that public school teachers often spend, 75% of their time just disciplining the kids. Let's imagine that's a gross exaggeration, and they only spend 25% of their time disciplining the children, which is probably maybe more accurate. I've spoken to some teachers. A quarter of the time in school is just, put your pencil away, I'm going to punish you, you're going to have to go to the principal. You're not teaching anything. You're just teaching them to be good people, to show respect to the teacher or respect to a colleague or not bully another child. Now, what's more effective in getting them to be good children? Threats, punishment, and bribery, coercion, or internalizing certain values, getting the child to recognize who they want to be as opposed to who the teacher tells them to be? Because most of us have a desire to be good.
Absolutely.
The only thing is we're not aware of that desire. Look, the most influential book of the 20th century, the most influential book of the 20th century was probably Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. And the essence of the book is if you want to really make a friend, if you want to impress someone and draw close to them, don't tell them you think they're smart. Don't tell them you think they're successful. Tell them you think they're good. More than anything, if you tell them you think they're good, they will open their heart to you because people want to be thought of as good and they want to be good. So why aren't our children in school doing this? Why do we see more and more shootings in the schools? Why is bullying becoming an American epidemic that we hear about almost every day? Now Lady Gaga has launched this whole initiative to stop bullying in schools because the kids don't have something like a moment of silence. They don't have time to reflect on who they want to be. Give them a moment to reflect on who they want to be. Don't think for a moment that you teach a kid mathematics and geometry and history that he's going to be a good kid. That doesn't mean anything.
No, that
if
I understand.
Give him some values, God willing, he'll be a good kid.
Yeah, and of course, just to jump in, hey Dan, one thing you've got to hopefully admit was that the Mike Brown you knew that was shooting heroin and using LSD probably would have been dead about 18, the crazy life I've lived. So Dan, you should be thankful to Jesus that I'm here. Stay on the line, Dan. Andrew wants to get contact info so I can give you a buzz in New York and we can hook up. So stay right there. Thanks for the questions. And Shmuley, we've got 30 seconds before the next break, but I knew Dan would be a good guy for you to talk to. Obviously, tomorrow night, I'm going to bring these tremendously powerful arguments, and maybe you'll recant on the spot. But since we haven't gotten there yet, tell our listeners why they should get your book, Kosher Jesus.
Why they should buy my book?
Yeah, because, I mean, we got our debate tomorrow night. But
What do you mean, Mike? What do you mean? You should buy my book because it'll make the world a better place. What's the question? You buy my book and the redemption will come basically immediately. You buy my book, and I wouldn't be surprised if the dead rose from their graves at the moment of the purchase. I wouldn't be surprised if, as you started to read the book that you bought, that world famine and hunger would cease, and all combatants and terrorists would lay down their arms. That's why you should buy my book. It is absolutely life-transforming, globe-transforming. I mean, you're talking about an epoch-defining book here, Kosher Jesus, Mike.
All right. Well, I wish you had more enthusiasm there and engaged in a little hyperbole. Rabbi Shmuley's new book, Kosher Jesus, firestorm of controversy, a lot of discussion generated, and it generated a book from me, The Real Kosher Jesus. You can order them both on Amazon.com. Back with my guest, Rabbi Shmuley Boteach.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, you know, when you have a soda can, you don't open it up and let it sit for an hour. That lets the fizz out. So when you've got a big debate coming tomorrow night, you don't open up everything the day before and get it out on the table. So this is just kind of an interview, a prelude to our big debate in New York City tomorrow. When I say hour, I mean my friend Rabbi Shmuley Boteach and yours truly, Michael Brown, at the New York Center for Ethical Culture. Whatever, I get the name wrong all the time. All the info is on our website, askdrbrown.org. My guest, known as America's most famous rabbi, has been an influential figure in Judaism and the culture for many years now. Shmuley, thanks so much for taking time to be on the program. I've got a question for you posted on my Facebook page. Was Jesus raised from the dead? If not, what do you make of the work of Pinchas Lapid, Israeli scholar who wrote a book saying that he really did believe Jesus rose from the dead, even though he himself was not a Christian?
First of all, Mike, I loved your soda fizz analogy. I never heard that before. Was that original? No,
I got it from somebody else, actually.
Damn good.
Yeah.
And I'm surprised that you're mentioning the most famous rabbi in America thing, which may or may not be true, instead of announcing that I was People Magazine's short, sexiest man alive. But
I missed that. You know, I must have missed that issue of People, because normally I get it and then I memorize it, and I must have missed that one. I'm so sorry.
It's cognitive dissonance. It was a conscious psychological suppression of facts.
Ah, okay.
But look, I was actually very interested when I read your book, The Real Kosher Jesus, which you are now publishing after I wrote my book, Kosher Jesus, and our debate should be fascinating.
God
willing. I didn't know about that book by Lapid, and I saw you quote from it. Very interesting. You know, I don't know a lot about him. I don't know a lot about his book. I'd have to read his book. And I never like commenting about things before I know more about them. But to the extent that what you're saying is accurate, that you have a Jew saying that Jesus rose from the dead, that's his opinion. I disagree with him. I think that my version of Jesus in Kosher Jesus is very well reasoned, very well argued. It has strong textual proofs from the New Testament. And I realize that maybe my Christian brothers and sisters are going to disagree with some of my conclusions. And my purpose is not to get Christians to think about Jesus the way I think about Jesus. On the contrary, I wrote the book to influence Christianity with the Jewishness of Jesus, not to change Christianity. It was to influence it. Christians need to know what Jews think of Jesus. They need to understand Jesus' mission in the light of Jewish thought, Jewish scholarship. And that allows us to use Jesus as a theological bridge between the two communities, even as we understand them in completely different ways. Now, I also get, Mike, that you're not going to agree with me because you feel that Jesus can only be understood in one way, which is as a divinity, Messiah, who rose from the dead, and in whom we have to repose belief in order for our sins to be remitted. But that's never going to be the Jewish view. It hasn't been for 2,000 years, and it's not going to change now. What is changing is, given the extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary, friendship from evangelical Christians especially towards the state of Israel and the Jewish community, and evangelicals are the most stalwart friends of the Jewish state, and God bless all of you for that. We're immensely, immensely grateful. It has allowed us, I think, to re-examine the traditional view of Jesus, which has been very negative. Mm-hmm. Jews have seen Jesus as a source of world anti-Semitism. They look at verses like John chapter 8, I think verse 47, where Jesus says that the Jews are children of Satan. I know, Mike, that you don't believe that he said that about all Jews, and he was only speaking to a particular group, etc., and you give other explanations to Jews. But be that as it may, you have to understand how Jews have seen these kinds of statements for 2,000 years, and how Christianity has viewed Jews and Judaism for 2,000 years, which has been extremely negative, and you know that more than most because you wrote an entire book on it. About Christian anti-Semitism.
Yep, absolutely.
So it's called Our Hands Are Stained with Blood. Is that the name of the book?
Yeah, and in fact, really, I've just got to jump in because we have a break. But in fact, you reached out to me after our first debate, wanted to get together and talk. It was as a result of me sending you that book, and you saw me through different eyes, saw some of my heart. So our relationship, our interaction is genuine. I really disagree with the book, but I absolutely commend Rabbi Shmuley for his courage in writing it, putting it out there, and making this effort. More when we come back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
My special guest this entire hour, in the midst of a whirlwind schedule, Rabbi Shmuley Boteach, Republican congressional candidate as well. We talked about that in the first half hour of the broadcast. 866-34-TRUTH. If you have a question for Rabbi Shmuley, I will try to get to him with some of these questions shortly. I just want to say this, though, to Shmuley in front of our listeners, because I've told you this privately. In the midst of our differences, I absolutely commend you for the courage to take the stands you've taken. It bothers me when people say, oh, he's just doing this for notoriety. We've had many a private conversation about these issues for years. You've told me what you believed about who Jesus is and your views of a historical reconstruction of things. And then you get constant criticism from different rabbis and others for debating me. And they'll often sit on the sidelines and say, you should have done this, you should have done that. I've said to him, he debates me. His view is that if Judaism cannot survive in the marketplace of ideas, then there's already defeat. And my view has always been, let's put both issues on the table so folks can listen and learn. So, Shmuley, in the midst of our differences and our friendship, I commend you for your courage. I commend you for being true to your convictions, and I thank you for that.
Well, I appreciate that greatly. And you know, right back at you. Look, Mike, our first debate was at somewhere in New York City, and I didn't like it, and you and I didn't get along. We did a second one, we became closer, then we went out to dinner. And actually, I discovered that you are decent in your core. You have decency in your core, that you treat people with respect and dignity. There were times in our debates where I saw that you wanted to uphold your respect for me, even as I could see it in your words, your choice of language. And that's why our debates have never become personal. They are vociferous. They are absolute hellish battlegrounds of theological debate and verses and scripture. But they're bereft of personal animus. I actually think people can learn a lot from our debates. I don't just mean in terms of the subject that we're debating, but I think in terms of how America only debates things by stripping people of their humanity and their dignity. If you don't like President Obama's policies, then he's a Muslim and he's an animal. If you don't like Rick Santorum, he's a religious nut who ought to be locked up. Why is everything so mean in America today?
All right, sorry? Yeah, Shmuley, let me just ask you this, and I want to get to some callers as well. How, if you run for politics, how can you rise above that? Because instantly you become a target. I mean, it would shock me if people would go after you on Jewish issues. I would hope that would just be kind of off limits. But it seems like the only way to get ahead is to sling mud at your opponents and to put out negative ads about your opponents. How could you possibly run for office and somehow transcend that without guaranteeing a loss?
Yeah. You know what? I appreciate the question because Mike, I have to admit, and all your callers will hear, when you run for office, there's a lot of fears that grip you. The fear that you'll be changed as a result of the race. The fear that you won't gain traction or a following, and you won't just harm yourself, you'll harm your message. Like, your message sucked. It's a lot of fear. First of all, I don't believe in capitulating to fear. I believe in trying to transcend it. I don't think the fear should make our decisions for us. But all one can do is dedicate oneself to one's values as you go through a totally new adventure and a totally new challenge. Am I afraid that I will have to do some of that? Yeah, of course I am. I think politics can be a cesspit at times, and it can be really ugly. And I sometimes ask myself, you know, I'm a Republican, but some of my closest friends in the whole world, you know, for example, Mayor Cory Booker, who's a Democrat, one of the most respected Democrats in the country, is like a brother to me, an African-American Christian. Sometimes I ask myself, maybe Americans want to live in a one-party state like China. Maybe the Democrats think the Republicans are evil and let's get rid of them. And maybe the Republicans think the Democrats are terrible and let's get rid of them. Do you want to live in China? You want to live in Russia where Putin just wins every few years and becomes a dictator? We need, you know, there's a beautiful metaphor that was given by the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Shneur Zalman, from the Russian town of Liadi. He said that a bird needs two wings to fly, and it needs the wings on opposite ends of its body, and the wings have to push in opposite directions. antithetical propulsion in order to fly. You need two parties. It doesn't have to be filled with vitriol. You know, your question strikes to something even deeper, Mike. It's not just it's not just about am I going to engage in attack ads? Am I going to do any of that? Which unfortunately prove to be very effective in politics.
Unfortunately,
but you know, am I going to say things that I don't mean in order to win over a following? You know, the other day, a guy asked me about gun control laws. Now, I believe in the Second Amendment. I believe we all have the right to bear arms, of course. And ultimately, it's the absence of values and bad people who do kill. And, of course, it's not guns. Guns are inanimate objects. Having said that, do I believe at times that we need some laws that circumscribe the availability of guns where they are being abused and misused and where people are dying as a result? Yeah, you bet. I do, but only as a temporary measure, because you have to preserve the Second Amendment. But you see, while I'm sitting there in a Republican caucus and people are asking me this, and my friend Cory Booker is trying to keep guns off the street because in Newark, 15-year-olds are blowing each other away, am I going to undermine the effort of a very special mayor to keep people alive because guns are being abused in this town? Now, you can't take away people's rights, but should there be laws that are logical and that are temporary while we get the situation under control and while we bring values back to people, like the value of human life, so we don't blow each other away on the streets? That's far more scary. Are you going to say things you don't mean depending on the audience you're afraid of?
Yeah,
you're in front of. And I don't want to be that person. I want to be true. And I want my political opponents to at least respect me. You know what? We disagree respectfully. We think his ideas are bad for America, but we respect him because he says what he means, and he means what he says, and he has integrity in this process. That itself would be, Mike, what we Jews would call a Kiddush Hashem, which is the sanctification of God's name.
Yeah, and truly, when we have a debate, it's the same thing. You can score points, but is it truthful? Is it accurate? Here I am on talk radio. I'd like for more and more people to listen to me. If I say certain things that I know are going to turn people off, you're saying, well, the fact is you lose your soul when you don't. Martin Luther King said a man dies when he refuses to stand up for that which is just and right. And we lose our souls in the process when we just become people pleasers. And often when we use the word politician, that's what we mean, that you go the way of greater votes and polling. And America is looking for authenticity. Let me grab a call to get us back to the kosher Jesus subject. John in Newark, thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown, how are you?
By the way, how do you like your mayor in Newark?
He's working with very little resources, like all mayors, I guess. And I believe he wants higher office. So.
His name just was mentioned. But go ahead, your question, John.
Yeah, well, I've known your mayor. I've known your mayor for 20 years. He's one of the finest human beings I've ever come across, Mayor Cory Booker. But he's a Democrat, and I'm a Republican. Say this with all my heart. But go ahead.
Yeah, I'm a young pastor, and I just have something. You know, you guys have more experience than I do. But I'm maybe you can steer me in the right direction, because I have a problem per se with the writing of books about the Bible, because I haven't found any precedent where any of the church leaders, Paul or Peter, any of them profited off writing about the Bible, when the Bible is the one true source and inspiration of God. It's the living word. How do we reconcile doing that?
Talking about the issue of making profit from it, or are you talking about the issue of making commentary on the Bible?
Well, I guess profiting. Like when you write, like when a pastor writes about grace and he profits off of it, he writes about maybe Jesus and he's profiting, or he writes about salvation, because you can't get it any better than the Bible's already put it.
All right, so let me just...
Mike, do you mind if I jump in here for a second?
No, please, go ahead.
I appreciate this. It just shows what a sincere and special audience you have listening to your radio show. What a question, man. Can I make something clear? It is not a sin to feed your family, to have enough money to have guests at your home. It's not a sin to drive a car that is decent and doesn't break down. It's not a sin to be dressed nicely without being dressed extravagantly. None of those are sins. And for all of that, you need money. Money is in Jewish thought, certainly, is neutral. It's not good and not bad. Just like people say drugs are bad. Drugs are great. Without drugs, you can't live. I mean, I have high cholesterol. Thank God that there are drugs to help me keep my cholesterol levels down. It's the abuse of drugs, which is bad. And it's the abuse of money, which is bad. So if you use, if you write a book about the Bible and you profit from it and you give a charity and you have guests and you feed your family and you dress your wife with dignity and you are dressed nicely so that when you walk down the street, people say, you know, look, religious people have class and dignity without extravagance. Let's move away from luxury and extravagance. That is what we Jews would call a mitzvah. It's your way of serving God. Money is not a bad thing. I mean, do you feel that it is?
All right, hey, tell you what, we've got a break here. I'm going to come back with my response, but I'll say, no, money is not a bad thing. It's how it's used and where our hearts are in relationship to it. So you've got the Rabbi Shmuley response to get mine. We come back. More to come. Stay with us.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Just a reminder, tomorrow night, 7:30 p.m. at the New York Society for Ethical Culture. The address details are on my website, askdrbrown.org. Rabbi Shmuley Boteach and I will be debating the subject of his new book, Kosher Jesus, which I have my own book, The Real Kosher Jesus. It should be a wonderful debate. And remember to all my Christian audience, your ticket to get in is to bring a Jewish friend with you so everybody can hear both sides of the perspective. Okay, right before the break, John from Newark had called. We lost Rabbi Shmuley there for a moment, so we'll have to reconnect. But John, just let me ask you a question. Do you or will you ever take a salary being a pastor?
Well, right now my church is young, so I can't even take one.
Right, but if it grows, would it be wrong? I mean, doesn't the Bible say
the laborers that we can take a salary?
Okay, but yeah. Do you ever preach or teach, or you just read the Bible publicly? Do you ever give your comments on it?
Yes.
Okay, so it's no different than writing a book. In other words, I'm not doing this for money. If I was doing this for money, I'd find another profession. You know, it's a tiny, tiny, tiny drop of money. Of people that get rich off the gospel, and it's a sin to preach so as to get rich. It's a sin so as to just to pursue riches for any reason. So my second book that I wrote was called The End of the American Gospel Enterprise, End of the American Gospel Enterprise. And I wrote it to call for the revival in America and to emphasize the need for revival in America. But at the same time, I wrote it to expose the materialism and greed of the American gospel culture. So if I wrote a book and thought, how can I write a book about grace that could make me rich? That would be a reproach. Just like if you said, how can I grow the church to 1,000 people so I could be rich? It'd be the very same thing. God has put teachers in the body, 1 Corinthians 12. Part of our role as teachers is to help equip the flock. You know, there are different ministries as well. So, John, let's just say people really liked your messages and then you put them out on CDs. Let's just say that to put them out on CDs cost you $1 per CD. So, you charge people $1 per CD. Then you had to have postage added in. You charge for that. It'd be the same thing. We put thousands of hours of free material on our website for anyone to get. We put out, the radio show is free 2 hours a day for everyone. When I write a book, it costs money to write a book. It costs money to produce a book. It costs money for a publisher to get the book out. And then what we've done for years, with almost every book I've published, I took all royalties and put them into ministry. So I couldn't benefit personally. And then we realized that there was actually an inequity with that, and that the ministry, that there were things I was doing for ministry that we weren't even getting supported to do. So it's the biggest thing is the attitude of the heart. And number one, just like you teach or preach your congregation, and I pray that the Lord uses you and blesses you and gives you much fruit, the same way you do that, I'm on radio, I teach and preach, and I also write books. And the same way the labor is worthy of his hire, those who preach the gospel should live by the gospel. In that same way, that's the way it is with writing books. If money comes in through it, you can do what Rick Warren did. He wrote a book that became a bestseller. He gives away 90% of his royalties, And then he paid his church back for all the salary they had ever paid him for the money that came in. So it's really the condition of the heart more than anything, John. Writing, okay. Teaching, preaching, pastoring. There's some people that do it for greedy motivation, and there's some people that do it to honor the Lord. And it, as long as you keep your heart pure with that, don't judge others, but keep your own hearts pure with that, everything will go great, and you'll be able to bless others and be blessed yourself, okay?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for the question.
I'm sorry.
Sorry, I cut you off. And I believe Rabbi Shmuley thought that he had until 2:50. So Rabbi Shmuley is gone. But I thought just with busyness of schedule, we'd get a half hour. He was glad to stay on an hour. So we got him for almost an hour, which is a wonderful blessing. And I'm going to take a question on his behalf. Troy, since you've been holding in Vidor, Texas, your question for Rabbi Shmuley, I will play Rabbi Shmuley and answer it.
Okay. Well, my question was, if Jesus wasn't the Messiah, then how would the Messiah prove that his lineage was from David, since all those records have been destroyed?
Yeah, the most common answer, I mean, some claim that there are DNA ways to prove it now, but Judaism traditionally, as it's developed over the centuries, has looked more for outward signs. In other words, if someone comes along, teaches Israel Torah, and the Jewish people turn en masse to God and to Torah, if he regathers the exiles back to Israel, if he successfully fights the wars of the Lord, if he rebuilds the temple, then you know he's the Messiah. In other words, if he does all those things, then you assume he's from the line of David, as opposed to someone saying they're from the line of David, but they don't fulfill the characteristics. So we make that a major issue, and I believe it's a fair issue because the Bible emphasizes the line of David. But on the flip side, traditional Judaism would more look at, does he do this, does he do this, does he do this, does he do this? If he does, then he must be the Messiah. Just like, from our viewpoint, the one who comes in the clouds of heaven and establishes his kingdom on the earth and rules and reigns from Jerusalem, we're going to ask for credentials. He's displayed who he is. But it's a great question, fair question. Thank you. Thanks again to Rabbi Shmuley for joining me. His book, Kosher Jesus, my book, about to come out, The Real Kosher Jesus. That's what we'll be debating in New York City tomorrow night. God willing, once the debate is over, a videotape of the debate will be made available for purchase. Also, just to mention this, you can now order a paperback copy, advanced copy on Amazon.com of The Real Kosher Jesus. So if you get Shmuley's book, get my book, read them side by side. I think you'll find it absolutely enlightening and eye-opening. But if you'd like to do this, and this is limited, we are numbering the first 500 hardcover copies of The Real Kosher Jesus. Our ministry alone has the hardcover copies. No one else will be having them. No bookstore anywhere. Just us. But you'll be able to get them for months and years, God willing. But the first 500 copies we're numbering, and then I'm signing them. And that's for a special gift of $50. So you're paying more than you'd normally pay for the book because you're getting a collector's item. And you're saying, hey, Mike, I want to stand with you in this new endeavor. As you're standing for Jesus, Yeshua, and reaching the Jewish people and debating these issues and having public dialogue, I want to stand with you and I want to help you on the line of fire to do this more and more. So your gift of $50 for a numbered and signed hardcover version of The Real Kosher Jesus. And again, that is limited in number. Call today 1-800-278-9978. That's 1-800-278-9978. You can just go online to askdrbrown.org and click on Line of Fire. You'll be able to do that. One more time, 1-800-278-9978. And again, for the address, details on the website, askdrbrown.org for the debate tomorrow night at the New York Center for Ethical Culture right near Central Park and 64th Street, something like that. My bottom line, why can't we put all the issues on the table? Why can't those who accept Jesus as Messiah and those who reject Jesus as Messiah sit down together, talk face to face, put the issues on the table, find our areas of commonality, find our areas of difference, learn from each other, and do our best to communicate the truth. Why not? Well, I hate to say I told you so, but I'm going to say I told you so, and there are some lessons that we can learn. We'll do it right here on the Line of Fire.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right. I don't want to say I told you so, because that's not the purpose of this broadcast, to gloat. And if I gloat, then people are going to be looking at me a month or 6 months or a year from now and saying to me, we told you so. But I've been sharing some things for some months, for some years. Every day that goes by, the things I've been sharing are becoming more clear. So I want to say to those who've been questioning me, to those who've been wondering, to those who've been doubting, well, I did tell you so, not to gloat, but to say maybe I'm right about these issues, and maybe it's important to listen to what I'm saying more carefully. Ah, got your attention. Michael Brown, thank you for joining us. I just had a very enjoyable hour with my friend and debating colleague and partner, Rabbi Shmuley Boteach. If you missed the broadcast later today, just go to AskDrBrown.org, click on the Line of Fire, and you'll be able to catch the interview with Rabbi Shmuley. Fascinating, enjoyable, as always. Tomorrow's broadcast will be a pre-debate broadcast, where I'll give you some of my thoughts before our debate in New York City on the question of kosher Jesus. And Wednesday, a special anniversary show, a triple anniversary, actually. I think you'll be blessed by it. But thanks for joining me today on the broadcast. Here's the number to call, 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-348-7884. Oh, and a very practical lesson I was reminded of today while packing for my trip. I just got back Sunday night. Actually, I unpacked and then packed today. But a very interesting lesson I was reminded of while it was this tiny, tiny Ziploc bag, I mean, barely the size of my thumb, and I was just throwing some vitamins in there for tonight, tomorrow, and Wednesday morning when I come back. It reminded me of a lesson. In fact, can I tell you that lesson? Looking at the clock, I can do it. I had these vitamins, some are really big ones, and I was putting them in, and then these little ones I started putting in, it reminded me of this lesson. There was a man had a very large vase. We'll call it a vase. Vase or vase. We'll say vase. And he had a bunch of big rocks, and he put the rocks in and filled it right up to the brim. And he said to everyone in the audience, this was a demonstration, how many of you think it's filled? Everyone raised their hands. And they said, ah, okay. Then he took a bunch of little rocks and started dropping them in, and they fell in all the little holes and places. And then right up to the top, he said, how many of you think it's filled now? And a few less hands, because now they're wondering. Well, then he took these tiny, tiny, tiny little pebbles, and then he dropped them in, one after another after another. I remember what reminded me of this was I was putting these vitamins in, and I put these big ones in and then these others. And he drops these tiny, tiny little pebbles in. How many think it's full now? Like, yeah, it seems full. And then he takes sand and pours sand in, and the sand goes in every last little crevice, and finally right up to the brim. How many think it's full now? And people realize it's got to be full. It's got to be full. What else could get in there? What was the moral of the story? What was the moral of the story? You think there's always room for more? No. That wasn't the moral of the story. The moral of the story was put the big rocks in first, because if you put them in at the end, there'll be no room for them. That's what I thought of with those vitamins. Put the big ones in first, because otherwise there'll be no room. You know what it means? It means in life. And this is going to tie in with themes of the show this hour. Put the big rocks in first. The things that are the most important between you and God, in your own life, your family, ministry, calling. Put the big rocks in first. Otherwise, there will be no room for them later. Quite a lesson. We come back, we'll talk about some failed prophecies.
Give us strength to always do what's right.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Hey, friends. Thanks so much for joining us on the Line of Fire broadcast. 866-34-TRUTH. If you want to weigh in, if you've got some questions, I told you so today, and I'll explain why I mean that. AskDrBrown.org. Click on the Line of Fire to weigh in. All right. Many of you remember the prophecies of Harold Camping, allegedly based on Scripture, that Jesus was going to be returning, what was it, May of last year, and then the end of the world would be October of last year, and there was a lot of attention, a lot of discussion. Some people spent their life savings advertising, this is going to happen. I talked to some very sincere but deluded folks about this in New York City last April or early May before their dates were about to transpire. And I was really concerned talking to some of you callers who had family members who had been roped in by this, who believed this stuff. And the question was, when they find out it's false, are they going to lose faith in Jesus? Are they going to lose faith in the Scriptures? Or will they realize that they were following a man, that they were following false teaching? Okay, well, basically, we address things. I told everyone we're going to have I'll answer your questions about this alleged second coming date the day after the event, because I knew it wasn't going to happen. Well, no one knows the time of the hour. I understand that. There are also things the Lord told us had to happen first, and they happened, didn't. So there's no question it was not going to happen. There's no question how Camping was wrong on that. And then come October, who's even thinking about it anymore? Well, finally, last week, he came out and deeply apologized and said he was wrong, and he was wrong on his interpretation of no man knows the day or the hour, which is so explicit, and he had this bizarre explanation for it. All right, he has apologized. He has said he was very wrong, and obviously I'm not here to bash him now. His error has been exposed. He is a very old man now, and I'm sure in many ways his world has crumbled. In my view, he should not have been on the air for years because of other error he was promoting. In my view, he was one that should have been singled out as a false teacher. In my view, once these prophecies failed, that should have been the nail in the coffin. In terms of getting off the air, it's unfortunate that a broadcast continued. But what's the I told you so that he was wrong? Oh, come on. Who didn't know he was wrong except for a tiny, tiny group of people? The I told you so is, friends, let us concentrate on what God has given us to concentrate on. If you want to avoid the pitfalls, the traps on either side of the road, stay in the middle of the road. If you know that on either side of the road there are fences, and you're walking down the road with your family, you got little kids, and on either side of the road there are fences, and if you touch them, it's 10,000 watts or 100,000 watts, whatever, it's going to be instant death. You don't run back and forth and lean, walk on the sides like little kids, lean in this direction. How far you get? Almost hit it, didn't quite hit it. No, you walk right down the middle, and you get your kids right in front of you, and you don't take your eye off them for a split second, and you warn them, and you move 1 minute, you could be fried alive. You move one moment, okay, mommy, okay, daddy, and you go right down the middle. That's what we need to do with the gospel, friends. Not get caught up on end time prophecy. The major emphasis of the New Testament is not on the when, it is on the what. The major emphasis of New Testament prophecy is not on the when of Jesus' return, but on the what of Jesus' return. What happens when he returns? The significance of it. We are longing for his appearing. Paul was longing for his appearing almost 2,000 years ago. Was that wrong? Well, Paul, it's not going to happen. No. It's right to be longing for his appearing, because he's longing for that day when the Lord returns and puts an end to sickness and death and pain and suffering, when the Lord returns and we're caught up to meet him and become like him, when the Lord returns and he establishes his kingdom on the earth. That's what we're waiting for. That's what we're looking forward to, becoming like him, being with him forever. The dead in Messiah rising first, those of us who are alive and know him being caught up to meet the Lord in the air and forever being with the Lord. That's what we're looking forward to. We're looking forward to his victory over the powers of darkness, his victory over the powers of chaos at work on this earth to abolish the terrible suffering that's plagued the human race since the fall and to bring in his glorious kingdom. Whether you believe it's a thousand-year kingdom or and then eternity or straight into eternity, we're looking forward to that return, that event, and the when is secondary. You know, it grieves me when I hear people don't want to take a stand, don't want to take action, don't want to stand for righteousness, don't want to go against the grain of cultural decay. Why? Well, you know, it's all going downhill. It's all going downhill. Hey, friends, can I point out to you? Can I point out to you that the early church did not think, well, it's all coming down, everything's going to collapse, Jesus is coming soon, which means there's only be cultural decay for us? No, they dealt with the social evils of their day, like infanticide, like the violence of gladiatorial combat, like the injustice towards women and other things. They dealt with it. They were preachers and teachers and livers of righteousness. Liver, not liver, the body organ, but people who lived it out. They did it. Come on, we've got to get past this. Well, he's coming soon, so this is just another sign that we're at Sodom and Gomorrah in the end. I'll tell you, it's going to be the end as quickly as we let it be the end, negatively speaking. And it may not be the end of the world, but it'll be the end of society as we know it, at least for a generation, if we continue to capitulate. 866-34-TRUTH. I've been getting emails from people about, what about these unusual manifestations? People getting caught up in all this crazy stuff and you know, this some of this hyper-mystical stuff, and they're believing these weird things. And those saying, well, is it real? You know, I was in a meeting, and people said there was gold dust, and was it real? Now, that's not a concern to me. What's a concern? If God decided that he was going to rain down gold dust on a meeting, that's his business. And if that's complete nonsense, that's his business. My business is to be a disciple and make disciples. That's what concerns me. Well, you think this latest fad is the Lord of that? That's really not the concern. The concern is it glorifying Jesus? Is it in harmony with Scripture? And is fruit being produced? We got to major on the majors, not date setting, not questions about manifestations. Someone emailed me with a concern. Folks in a particular group were just getting caught up in secondary things and wanted to get it into all this mystical experience stuff. And you know, how do you avoid it? You avoid it by focusing on walking with the Lord, by living by the word, by being a disciple and making a disciple. And you can have intimacy with God with or without an unusual experience. You can have intimacy with God in deep fellowship and love with or without an intimate experience. Nancy and I, on this Wednesday, God willing, will celebrate our 36th wedding anniversary. And we became close and really fell in love almost a couple years before we got married, shortly after the Lord saved her. So we're going on being together as soulmates in 38 years now. We don't need a supernatural manifestation for our love. We don't need the ground to shake or the roof for the house to open, or we don't need that. And if you know, when I said, honey, I love you so much, and she said, I love you, it's our anniversary, if the ground shook and the roof of the house opened and suddenly a light shone in, okay, wonderful. You are my children, a blessed couple. We'll take it. That's fine, but we don't need that. No, we're getting caught up with secondary things. It's so common. The longer I walk with the Lord, the more of a meat and potatoes guy I become in terms of majoring on the majors, majoring on the things that come first. You say to me, well, then why are you getting caught up with this homosexual activism thing? What a tangent. No, it's not a tangent. It is the principal threat to religious freedom today. It is the principal threat to freedom of conscience. It is the principal threat to freedom of speech. It is the principal threat to the definition of family and the definition of even what we believe scripturally about male and female. And if you don't believe me, how about this story from National Public Radio, NPR? A mom becomes a man and a family sticks together. This spring, Les and Scott Grant Smith will mark their 25th wedding anniversary. The couple raised two daughters along the way. But 15 years ago, they hit a crisis that nearly shattered their family. Les was keeping a secret, and that became a problem. Well, Les was not Les then. Les was a woman. They solved it as a family in a way that kept them together and happy. And here's what happens. Les, who's still considered the mother of the children, Les realized that she was in the wrong body, and Les then going to become a man. So here's a picture of the two of them. You can see who the genuine man is and who the one attempting to be a man is. They've both got similar looks, similar hairstyles, glasses, goatees. Obviously, one due to hormones, one due to what's natural. Friends, listen to me. Oh, and here's a picture of the daughters with their mother, who now has a beard and a goatee, speaking about her transition from a woman to man in 1997. And on and on. Friends, if you don't want this to be the norm in the schools and the norm of what your kids are learning and the norm of what's coming to society, it's up to the church to provide a voice of moral sanity and spiritual clarity. Will we do it? Will we do it?
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I will not stop sounding the alarm, friends. I will not stop speaking the truth as long as God gives me strength. And I'm telling you that we continue to slide down the slippery slope with such abandon in so many key moral and cultural issues. I'm going to come to a few more shortly, that as we're sliding so quickly, we even lose sensitivity to the point that things that a year or two or five people would have guaranteed us would never happen are now being celebrated. And if you don't celebrate it, there's something the matter with you. 866-34-TRUTH. Remember, May 8th, everyone living in North Carolina, be sure to vote on May 8th. So that you can look your kids and your grandkids in the eye, so you can look yourself in the eye in the mirror, so you can look God in the eye, so to say, and vote to uphold marriage as a union of a man and a woman. And if someone tells you, you vote like that, gay kids are going to kill themselves, tell them, how dare you use them as pawns, and tell them, we have a message in Jesus that saves people from death and saves people from suicide and saves people from depression. The story I was just reading, NPR celebrates woman who wants to be a man. The story casually weaves in ridiculous sentences like this one from a news communique I have. Les, that's the mother who had sex change surgery, become a man, and now the husband is married to a man. Les says he never stopped considering himself the girl's mother. That sound a little strange, that sentence, to you, anybody? Les says he never stopped considering himself the girl's mother. And they still think of Les as their mom who is a man, their mom who has a goatee, their mom who identifies as a man, has a man's name. They think of Les as their mom. You tell me these kids are going to have a normal view of sexual identity? You tell me these kids are not going to have some level of confusion? My heart goes out deeply to people like this. The confusion they've lived with, the torment they live with, there is a better way. Yeah, oh my, that's right. I just sent a picture, the article, to our guys in the studio here. How about this from England? This is yesterday. A law to allow same-sex marriages will force Christians to conduct gay weddings in church, it was claimed yesterday. Huh? An analysis of equality law by Church of England lawyers suggests assurances from David Cameron and his ministers that no church will be compelled to provide such ceremonies are worthless. Ministers have repeatedly said since the plan for same-sex marriage was announced 5 months ago that it would apply in civil law only and that gay wedding ceremonies would not be imposed on churches. But lawyers working at Church of England, Church of England's church house headquarters have said equality laws will mean churches have to treat gay couples asking for a wedding in the same way they treat heterosexual couples. Just listen to what some ministers in England have to say about this. All right, let's see if we can get this to play properly. I've got to run it from a different location because we didn't have it set up. Well, if it does, it does. Otherwise, take my word that this is what they are saying. Look, we already have laws in the states that prohibit sexual discrimination based on sexual orientation. So we've already had this. It's a well-known case, several years old now. In New Mexico, two lesbians contact Elaine Photography. It's a Christian woman. She and her husband have a photography company. Contact Elaine Photography. They want her to film, to photograph their same-sex commitment ceremony. She says no. You know, as a Christian, that violates her conviction. But just politely says, no, we don't do that. And they take it to court. They take it to court. As a result of that, she was found guilty of discriminating based on sexual orientation, friends. And she has been fined. Obviously, there's an appeal on this, but the last that I heard, she was found guilty and fined. There are different cases like that cropping up all over America. And bear in mind all those living in New York, once marriage was redefined, Democrats pushed it and four Republicans caved in. Well, the Republicans caved in because allegedly, you know, we have this provision that churches, ministries that differ with this would not have to participate. I mean, what a cop-out. What a cop-out. What a Hezekiah syndrome-type cop-out. Well, it's going to be okay for us right now. It's not okay for us right now. Well, no sooner as that happened, gay activists began to say, this is wrong. This is we are now legislating bigotry. We are now legislating discrimination. We are now legislating things so that these churches are allowed to hold on to their bigotry. You have to understand, friends, we are in this situation now in America where if you simply say, well, of course, marriage is the union of a man and woman, you will be labeled a bigot. May I remind you that just 1 year ago this April, I was in Orlando, Florida, University of Central Florida, debating Professor, Eric Small on the issue of same-sex marriage. You can watch it for free on our website. He proposed the topic, same-sex marriage, should it be legal? This is in Florida, where an amendment has already passed saying that marriage is the union of a man and a woman. You'd think college campus, this is fine to discuss. It's now a major issue in the political campaign. No, there was outrage over it. Gay activists trying to shut it down. The Inclusion and Diversity Department. That means everything but. That means totally exclusive, and you toe the line our way, and if you hold any views that are different, you're out. It is the complete mockery of inclusion and diversity and tolerance. It's the most intolerant, exclusive thing that's out there. It poses as inclusivity, tolerance, diversity. Some of their folks opposing the debate, some university vice presidents opposing it. It was such a hot topic. Come on, this is a university. This is a campus. This is something. And by the way, Andrew, by all means, Dan's around. Sure, man, I'll talk to Dan again. So easier to talk than to type and talk at the same time. Here's the deal. I'm going to do this debate, University of Central Florida. Okay? Such an uproar. The day before the debate, 11 people on a conference call, not me, I was not in on it, 11 people on a conference call, including university vice presidents, inclusion and diversity department people, gay activists, chief of police of the campus, the only way they let us go ahead with this, the only way they let us go ahead with this debate was if we had four armed policemen present. That's how much things are being stifled. That's how much religious freedoms, freedoms of speech, freedom of conscience are being taken away. And Kai Feldblum, a Georgetown University professor, openly lesbian, appointed to an equal opportunity commission by Mr. Obama, by President Obama, has said that when there's a conflict between sexual liberties and religious liberties, she cannot see a case where religious liberties win. We have been telling you, friends, And each day, the handwriting on the wall becomes clearer and clearer and clearer and clearer to the point now that Church of England clergy are concerned that law on same-sex marriages will mean that churches will be forced to conduct gay weddings. We already have it forced on our teachers and our schools, already have that forced on them. If you don't feel now is the time to speak up, act up, at what point? Well, you don't tell me Jesus is coming any minute. Do the right thing today. Maybe if we do the right thing today, he'll come even more quickly. Back with more.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, look at this piece of news from The Telegraph in England, March 10th. Christians have no right to wear cross at work, says government. Christians do not have a right to wear cross or crucifix openly at work. The government is to argue in a landmark court case. And a highly significant move, ministers will fight a case at the European Court of Human Rights in which two British women will seek to establish their right, establish their right to display the cross. My, oh my, Michael Brown, thanks for joining us today on The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Last hour, so an hour and a half ago, I had on the air with me my friend Rabbi Shmuley Boteach as we talked before our debate tomorrow night. And during the broadcast, I only took a few calls because I wanted to give time to my guest. But there was a call from a gentleman that I have not talked to in decades. Now, we've interacted by email a little bit here and there. The funny thing is we basically continued to run the race we were running from years and years back and just develop and grow into it more and more. And we went to high school together. He knew me in my heavy drug days. In fact, he was not that far behind in his drug use back then. And I don't know whose hair was long, and we probably both looked equally stupid with it. But anyway, at least I did. I think he did also. Anyway, he's gone on to be an attorney. He teaches college classes, and point after point on the opposite side of the road from me, point after point. So anyway, we've had some fun interacting by email on and off, and he called in, and I saw the full name, so I had a talk with Rabbi Shmuley. I've never done this. I've never had someone call the first hour and talk for all, then call the second that I can remember this way. But when he just called back to discuss same-sex marriage and so on, I thought, we got to do this. So, hey Dan, do you mind if I mention your whole name?
Absolutely, Mike. Pleasure.
All right. Dan Seidel, we went to West Hempstead High School together. And let's just take 2 minutes to do this, and then we can fight, okay? How's that?
Absolutely.
All right. Do you agree with my assessment that we both look pretty stupid with our long hair back then, or do you still think
we
look – Oh, okay. So
absolutely. Mine's in a plastic bag now in my drawer.
Oh, so you saved yours. I've just preserved mine on my from LSD to PhD testimony. All right. People have heard me talk about my days before I was a believer in Jesus when I was called Drug Bear and Iron Man.
Yeah,
now, your head was a little foggy then, too. But what do you remember about me back then in the drug days and then after I became a believer in Jesus? You have a unique perspective, Dan.
I knew you. I knew John Cavasian, the rest of the guys beforehand. Before you found religion, you were crazy. You were out of your mind, and we all looked as if you were going to die. Really, and that's the way we looked at it. And then when you popped out of this thing, it was like, I'll use the expression, "Thank God that something dragged you out."
Now, do you believe in God, Dan?
No.
Okay, thank God.
These things.
Yeah, thank God it's a figure of speech, though, right?
Yeah,
so
it was always a question of faith.
Why do you think, Dan, when you looked at me, that I was going to kill myself or die from the way I was living?
I had no idea. The drugs are very, very seductive. It really is. It in terms of science or neuron analysis, when these things go into the brain, your brain gets addicted to these things, your body gets addicted to these things, your mind starts thinking a certain way. Bell curve, you're off the beat track. You're out of the 80%. You were beyond even the 10% on a fringe.
All right. So, folks, just when I share my story, just know I'm not exaggerating. And was there any kind of a dramatic change when I became a believer in Jesus?
That night when you sat out in front of your house and you saw God, and it was a huge change. You didn't associate with anybody else anymore that was doing that sort of stuff. Went with John, you went with Mike and the rest of the guys of the church, the Pentecostal stuff. You guys had a band.
We did. And Dan was a Jewish guy then, Jewish drug user, and now a Jewish lawyer. Doesn't believe in God. We share a lot of values together. When we come back, Dan, I want you to tell me why you differ with me on the subject of gay marriage.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I've got a stack of interesting items to get to, but something more interesting has happened. Someone I graduated high school with, class of 1973, knew me in my drug days, knew me when the Lord transformed my life, and I knew him in his drug days, and then we've been in limited email contact in recent years. He's now a lawyer. He's got an interest in values, positive values for family, other things, but does not believe in God. And happened to call in earlier. We're back on the phone. So, Dan Seidel, my personal welcome to the Line of Fire.
Mike, thanks very much. I appreciate this, really.
You're an attorney?
I'm an attorney. I'm a dad. My kids are grown. My daughter's in Israel right now. I'm divorced at this point.
I'm an
environmental guy. I'm a constitutional teacher. I'm an inspirer of youth. I hope. I'm taking kind of a parallel track to what you do, but without the faith.
Without the faith. Yeah, now the first hour when you called in and we talked with Rabbi Shmuley, that was an interesting interaction. I don't want to repeat that now, but right. Let me just ask also, where do you do your teaching, Dan?
Berkeley College in White Plains. I teach business law, law and art of the argument, law and society.
And what's your daughter doing in Israel now?
She's on Project Birthright, seeing the homeland.
Wow. Fascinating. Now, what happens if she like becomes religious while she's there?
A big event, that'll be her life if she likes living be well. I taught in Sunday school and I taught secular Jewish education. Mm-hmm. Taught it from, you know, my commie perspective, things like that. I don't deny anybody the right to religion. In fact, I encourage it if they want that. And what you were talking about, you're correct. There is an assault on religion today, and it's unconscionable. The Constitution, our document, does not say that that's what should be done.
Right. So yeah. So we agree on that. And yeah. So in the old days. So here we were with our with our long hair. We were both Jewish kids, going to the same high school. I was from a different town, but we shared that same high school. So we knew each other in the drug days, and we used to talk about spiritual things when we were getting high. And then my life was transformed. Whatever happened to Vinny, our buddy there?
Vinny is a major money man. He lives in Connecticut now, and he's been around the world, divorced and married 3 times.
Really?
Yeah, he's got some contact with some of our old buds.
Does he have any religious beliefs or non-beliefs?
None. Nothing. He dropped it.
His
parents were, you know, Catholic. Vinny is a very, very still, from what I've gathered from other people, and I haven't spoken to him in years, Vinny has become very, very cynical. But nothing where it encourages a moral value to the youth to get them involved in things.
Yeah. All right. Well, I got to hopefully renew contact with our old buddy Vinny. So Dan, how is it that you transitioned from the drug world? You weren't as crazy as I was, but then again, as we agreed,
one
that
step
was
behind you.
Yeah, we were running in the same wrong direction. What happened in your own life to bring our transformation, or did you still get high before you teach at college?
No, to the second question, but what happened to the
transformation? Just, hey, you never know.
Occasionally there's a desire. Bottom line is that you grow up, and you see different things, and there is no time to do stupid stuff. And you make a decision based upon whatever moral values you needed or whatever you needed to do to stop the nonsense and get on with living. And that's basically what happened by going to New Paltz, where I was heavily involved in that sort of stuff. I thought I was going to die one night.
In college?
In college. I had done a lot of cocaine and felt my heart popping out of my chest. And basically it wasn't a spiritual awakening, but it was an awakening. Like, you better stop doing this or you're a dead man. And it stopped. Now, you would say that's God moving through me.
Yeah, well, it could be a common sense warning. I mean, I do believe that there's a moral nature that's put into us by God fundamentally. I mean, you mentioned the first hour, talking to Shmuley, an altruistic DNA, you know, the question of where we get our sense of right and wrong from. But, yeah, I mean, listen, I prayed for you back then. I don't doubt that God spared your life, and maybe the prayers are still working. So let me ask you this, Dan.
Touche.
Yeah, you live in New York.
Yes, I do.
And obviously that's where I used to live. I'm in North Carolina now, but I've got a lot of friends, pastors there, and we absolutely oppose the redefinition of marriage. I assume you were for it, and you're for it on a national level?
I really, if people are good and righteous, I don't care what they do. I don't care who they marry. As long as they're doing, quote-unquote, the right thing for the right reason, as long as you make people's lives better and you encourage, you know, tikkun olam, you know, taking care of the earth, what difference does it make if you're gay, lesbian, homosexual? It doesn't define a characteristic of a person. If I start making lines and drawing lines, then I'm a person of not inclusion.
All right, but aren't you already drew lines by talking about being good? Isn't that based on your subjective evaluation on what's good?
Yes, correct, absolutely.
All right, so you've drawn your own lines, and basically, I mean, you're living out a scripture that says every way of a man is right in his own eyes.
Correct.
Because you're trying to do what you think is good. Do you think marriage should be limited to two people?
On a civil law message, correct, yes. Because then you get into issues of surrogacy in terms of heirship, division of estates, things like that. I look at things from a legal perspective as well, constitutionally. It makes it a lot easier to administer the law when it's a one-on-one because we've had a history, possibly 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years, you know, singular marriage. One person, you know.
All right, so you realize, though, that, of course, your arguments work against same-sex marriage then for those same reasons. We've got a 6,000-year history, and the moment you have two men or two women bringing a kid into the world, it guarantees that the kid is not going to be connected with either the mother or the father, and then even something as simply as a family tree doesn't even exist anymore in many ways. And you have surrogacy issues. You have you ever heard about kids that are children of anonymous sperm donors and what they go through?
Yes.
The percentage.
Some of those in the Shoah, in the Sunday school that we were in.
Okay.
I felt bad for them.
Right. But do you think that a kid is entitled to know their mom and dad as much as possible?
Yeah, I do. And on a bell curve, on a mathematical level, I believe that, yeah, there can be 80% man and woman, and that's what should be the norm. But if you do go the end pieces, I'm not going to hold it against you. I don't want to hold it against you. It doesn't make a difference as long as you're taking care of the earth and you're taking care of the people and you're making people smile. It's like when you look at little kids and you take something away from them at 3 years old, there's a gut reaction, and there's a thing of it's not fair. Most kids will fall into that category. And that is the norm. That is the cultural norm. That's what we see. The outside bell curve, some kid will go, I'm going to hit you. Or the other kid will go, you know, and shirk away and things like that.
But just a question, though. Yeah. I think we both agree that we don't want the government getting involved in every area of our personal lives as much
Absolutely.
As possible.
Absolutely.
All right. Why is the government even involved in marriage at all? It's because marriage conveys benefits on society, so society conveys benefits on marriage. And that is a man and a woman coming together with the possibility of procreation and a kid being raised in a home where they have the best chance of knowing their mom and dad, which is the best social welfare policy for the nation. So even leaving God out of the picture for a moment, once you redefine that and just say it's the union of two people, it could theoretically be the union of two brothers or two sisters. It now breaks the whole pattern of why society gets involved in marriage. It breaks the pattern of kids knowing both a mom and dad. You now end up doing a lot of harm. You, as much as people laud, well, you know, kids in same-sex households are just the same. They're not just the same. For example, a girl raised by lesbian moms, the studies would indicate she's 7 times more likely to have lesbian sexual encounters. You've got guys with all kinds of gender identity disorder issues. You know, more gender ambiguity raised in same-sex households. That's not good for society. I'll just make this fun for you, but we'll keep talking. We got a break. For someone as smart as you, all right, we'll go back to our early days. All right,
yeah,
this is with a smile.
Language is you, Mike. Yeah.
Right. So for somebody as smart as you, as well educated as you, such an incisive thinker, Your arguments seem very, very childlike. This make the world a better place, bring everybody a happy smile, you know, take care of the earth.
Yeah.
Come on, man.
I mean,
that sounds like you're still getting high, buddy. That sounds like the old hippie ideals, you know,
kumbaya
kind of stuff. Come on, man.
That's the ACLU background. Come on. Really. No, seriously, that is the blinders that are on, that I was born with, my cultural bias, if you will. My gut reaction is, yeah, man was made for a woman, woman's made for a man. That's the way it's supposed to work in our biologic culture, in our biologic niche. That's what it is. You really can't have children without having a man and a woman. And
yeah, on some level. Yeah, and I've just got to jump in, but thanks for the honest answer. Tell you what. I want to chat with you one more minute after the break, and then make sure you leave Andrew the contact info so we can hook up in the city and then really engage again and go at it.
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Just posted a note on my private Facebook page. You're not going to believe who I'm talking to, Dan Seidel. We went to high school together. We got high together. I got saved and did my best to witness to Dan. And he didn't believe then. He still doesn't believe, but he's alive and well. So everybody, put Dan Seidel on your prayer. I know he's going to be so happy. I know this is going to make his day. Put Dan on your prayer list. So, Dan, all right, listen, I've got your private contact info, and I'm in and out of the city this week, but then at the end of the month, God willing, I'm in for a longer period of time, and maybe we could hook up. It would be
absolutely
a joy.
Yeah.
But I've got a real serious question for you.
Okay.
And that is, if you realize that there was actually a God who created you, a personal God who loved you, let's even put aside the Jesus issue for the moment, is there anything in that that's positive to you or that could open up a whole new dimension of life and meaning to you, or is that just associated with negative religious ideas to you?
It's associated with negative religious ideas, but I'll condition this. Since having kids and involving myself in their lives and theirs in mine, a current thread, if you want to be scientific about this, running through a universe, you want to be hippie about it, call it a Gaia mentality. Do I acknowledge that that could exist? Yeah, possibly. Do I want to call that a Godhead existence? I don't know. I don't think so. And that's probably where the difference between us lies.
All right. Well, hey, listen, that's certainly a softening of tone.
Absolutely.
from decades back. Yeah. But seriously, Dan, this show will be memorable to me, not just for having my friend Rabbi Shmuley, but for us reconnecting on the air. And thanks for doing it. If you know any of our old friends from high school, tell them to call in. I got our guys in the studio here saying I need to get hold of an old friend once a
week. You want John to call in?
Hey, yeah. Yeah, I mean, John, yeah, whoever you can find, whether they agree or not, whatever the journey's been, we can compare notes from the old days. That listeners will get a kick out of that, and then let's do our best to connect in the New York area one of these days. But thanks for calling, and may I say to you, may God richly bless you, Dan.
Thank you, Michael, and to you.
All right,
seriously, it's been
all right.
A blast.
Same
thanks,
here.
Guys. See ya. Ciao.
Ciao. Wow. Well, listen, we had our intense interaction. You got to remember, these guys knew me. When I was really lost, when I tell you I was really lost, I was really lost. When I tell you the craziness of my lifestyle, the wickedness of my lifestyle, the intensity of the drug use, it's not to boast about sin. It's to boast about the goodness of God that rescued me from that. Here's an old friend. It was one of the ones that didn't get saved when I did, but we would talk by the hour about these things, and nice to hear Dan's tone softening and him really having a heart to do good. Well, he has life and breath. So let's pray for Dan Seidel. Will you do that? Friends, I continue to sound the alarm on 100 different fronts. Oh, what a story from England. We would have aborted her. couple sues health center for wrongful birth of daughter born with Down syndrome after botched test failed to pick it up. A prenatal test showed the couple's daughter would be normal and healthy. Shocked when blood tests after the birth confirmed the baby had Downs. Botched test had taken sample from the mother rather than the fetus. Now Ariel and Deborah Levi are suing Legacy Health for $3 million. They say they love their daughter, but have received death threats over the case. I am not minimizing challenges, difficulties that people face with a Down syndrome kid. I'm not saying that it's easy or that you just wish that on everyone. What I'm saying is this is outrageous. And the hospital blew things, but the idea, well, we would have aborted her, and now $3 million health suit or suit against Legacy Health. Oh, come on, friends. There's now an article in USA Today, will America cull people with Down syndrome? In mid-October, pregnancy, as we know it, forever changed in America. The company Sequinom announced that with simple blood draw at 10 weeks of gestation, a pregnant woman can now learn with 99% accuracy whether her fetus has Down syndrome. And a large percentage of women who find out their baby's going to have Down syndrome abort that baby. This despite the fact that families over and over again speak of how their life has been enriched with a child with Down syndrome. Brian Scottko, who wrote this article, said, my research colleagues Sue Levine, Rick Goldstein, and I have recently surveyed more than 3,000 families nationwide who have a member with Down syndrome. The positive results might surprise some. 99% of parents say they truly love their son and daughter with Down syndrome. 88% of brothers and sisters say they are better people because of their sibling with Down syndrome. People with Down syndrome themselves spoke up too. 99% are happy with their lives, and 97% like who they are. My sister with Down syndrome certainly does. I often wonder how many Americans can say the same. But will this matter? Our society has historically allowed its people to become the final arbiters about their destinies. It goes on, African-Americans, Jewish people after the Holocaust, so on. Now people with Down syndrome and their families have joined the debate about their own condition. Like groups before them, their self-descriptions stand in contrast to the ways in which others might describe them. Friends, isn't this just an inevitable direction that our society is taking? And with it will come increased calls for euthanasia. With it will come increased judgments about who is really worthy to live and who is not worthy to live. So a shocker, but not a shocker, because this is the way we've been going. Oh, by the way, do you know about President Obama's ex-nanny? Do you know about Evie? She once looked after Barry Obama, the kid who grew up to become the world's most powerful man. This is an article from Jakarta, Indonesia. Do you know that this nanny was transgender? Now his transgender former nanny has given up her tight flowery dresses, her brocade vest, and her bras, and is living in fear on Indonesia's streets. So this is a man who dressed as a woman. Oh, it's a shame that he's endured a lifetime of taunts and beatings because of his identity. It's a shame that he's subject to this abuse, but he needs help from the inside. He's a man, not a woman. This is someone who raised our president. It's probably very loving and caring, but could that have influenced our president's views as well? Absolutely. Absolutely. What's the key? The key is for us to recover biblical morality, biblical family, to live lives that give proof to the meaning of being people of God, children of God, and demonstrate to the world that God's ways are best, male, female, moms and dads, people knowing God, making him known, not just nasty people with old, crusty religious beliefs, but people living out the life of the gospel. Come on, friends, let's do it. What are we waiting for? Special pre-debate show tomorrow on the Line of Fire. Remember, you can order the paperback version of The Real Kosher Jesus. You can pre-order right now on Amazon. But to get your special hardcover, numbered, and signed edition, a collector's item of The Real Kosher Jesus, $50 gift to help us with the work that we're doing. Join us today. Will you do that? 866-34-TRUTH. 866-348-7884. One more time, 866-348-7. Excuse me, 1-800-278-9978. I gave you the wrong number. Can't believe it. Bottom line, friends, we have life. We have truth. We have the foundations, the ways, the purpose, the plan of God. Let us live this out and demonstrate it to the world.